I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday at the Movies. The 20th Annual Maryland Film Festival kicks off tonight at the SNF Parkway Theater here in Baltimore. Filmmakers from around the world will gather on Charles Street to screen their latest work and to talk about the many facets of their art in panel discussions and workshops. Audiences will be treated to a buffet of more than 40 narrative films and documentaries, plus 10 series of short films. Today on Midday, a preview of the Maryland Film Festival with its director and founder, Jed Dietz, the actor Jim Belushi, and cinematographer Bradford Young. Plus, film directors Matt Porterfield, Joe Trapea, and Eric Young introduce us to their latest films. Midday at the Movies starts right after the news. Indeed, it was 20 years ago this week that Jed Dietz introduced the Maryland Film Festival for the first time. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. The 20th edition of the festival does begin tonight, and we will have a preview with Jed Dietz and some of the filmmakers who will be part of the action, which brings together more than 120 local and international filmmakers for panel discussions, workshops, and screenings of some 40 feature films and 10 short film series over the course of the next 5 days. So Jed Dietz joins me here in Studio A, along with film director Matt Porterfield, who will be introducing his new movie, Sawler's Point, at the festival. Gentlemen, good to see you both.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
And if you'd like to chime in, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Jed, 20 years. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
Anything different about this year's edition than in years past?
Everything's different.
These are all the movies are different.
Yeah, right, exactly. 130 things different. We are launching a new young people series that will play at the Parkway afterwards, too, called Generation Parkway. And because this is, we're approaching tomorrow our first year anniversary in the Parkway, Matt's film, which will be, you know, highlighted, of course, we're excited about it being in the film festival, will then launch its national release at the Parkway the following week. So the first place anybody in America can see it after its festival run will be at the Parkway.
And Matt, the new film is called Sawler's Point. It's your fourth movie, is that right? Am I counting right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about it.
It's about a young man, 25, who's just released from prison, living with his dad in Dundalk. And he's looking for work, looking for meaning. And trying to figure out what to do with his life. It's about him and his relationship with his father and some of the people from his past, sort of good and bad.
And the young man is played by whom?
A local actor named McCall Lombardi.
Mm-hmm. And the father is played by an actor that a lot of people know.
Yes, Jim Belushi.
Jim Belushi, and we have Jim Belushi on the line. We'll get to him in just a second. Let's listen to a little clip of Sawler's Point. This is the new movie by Matt Porterfield that will have its premiere tomorrow at the Maryland Film Festival.
If you broke into my house, I'm going to have to press charges.
I don't blame you. I just wish you'd wait till morning. Think about it.
Carol, I don't feel safe. I feel like I have to get a restraining order.
Don't do that, please. Please, just sleep on it.
No, don't patronize me. I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. Where is he?
I do not know.
What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? I want to go home, and I can't go home, and I can't leave my house by itself, clearly. I have to call the police.
No. Please don't. Really, think about his position here. I mean, what are the cops going to do, really?
Are you kidding me?
A clip from Matt Porterfield's new movie, Sawler's Point. You heard Zazie Beetz playing the role of Courtney and Jim Belushi playing the father named Carol. Jim Belushi joins us on the line from L.A. Jim, welcome to Midday.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon there. It's morning here.
Right. It is indeed. And the opening...
that clip was great.
Yeah,
hey, Jim.
The movie. And that scene is so beautifully shot and performed. And it's a very emotional scene. It made me tear up when I was watching it.
Yeah. And,
and you only heard half of it.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, what's it? What was it like working on a movie? You've done a lot of TV. You've done a whole bunch of different movies. Matt's movies all so far have sort of concentrated on very specific locations here in and around Baltimore. Did you know much about Baltimore? Did you prep for the role by learning anything about Dundalk, the area in which this movie was shot?
I did all of it. That's what you do as an actor. You study the area, you study the culture, and Matt led me through all of that study. The only thing I knew about Baltimore was that's where I learned as a kid to drive offensively.
Who needs defensive driving?
I traveled to New York, and a guy was really nice, and he was cutting through this terrible traffic jam, and I looked to the right, and he went, don't look.
Sounds about right.
So he goes, that's the way you drive here. So that's one thing I knew about Baltimore was aggressive.
An important thing.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, Matt, hello, Matt. I miss you so much.
Hi, Jim. I miss you, too. I wish I was out there in Oregon with you.
Matt's style of filmmaking was so impressive when I watched the three films that he made. His pace, his tone, his grounded sense of reality in the character and situations. It's just breathtaking to watch. And when I watched this movie, I think it's his best film to date because he actually, for the first time, hired professional actors.
Including yourself.
Including myself.
Is there a particular vibe to a Matt Porterfield set? You've been on a lot of sets. You've done a lot of TV, a whole bunch of movies. Each one of them has its own sort of vibe, its own sort of culture, I would imagine. What can you describe the mood, the vibe, the feeling on the set of a Matt Porterfield movie, of this one?
Well, Matt's short of a cult leader. Everybody that works on the film can see the passion in his eyes, and everybody submits to it, and they're there to serve him, and it's a beautiful thing to watch. And he allows people to bring what they want to the film, whether it's craft service all the way to what we want to do with the character, and then he just gently guides it in a direction if he doesn't feel it's moving him with authenticity. He's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You're beautiful, man, Matt.
Thanks, Jim. Jim, I love you.
Look, you two, get a room here.
That's my point, because there's no money. There's no money, you know, to be made. And it's all about, you know, love and character and storytelling.
Yeah, and Matt, it's also
beautiful.
Matt. Let me ask both of you this question, but let me start with you. What's it like working with a seasoned actor like Jim Belushi, who's done so many different kinds of projects, for the last 30 some years? He's been in the business. Working with an actor with his kind of cred, his kind of experience, as opposed to some of the other actors that you were working with in your earlier films, who were certainly less experienced.
Well, I learned a lot. I can tell you that. I learned how closely we can examine each scene and the performance, as Jim did. And I also, I was really struck by his energy. Jim, you gave, more to the other actor in the scene as you did to, the camera. And that meant a tremendous amount to me. It's something I hadn't really seen anybody do before, and that comes from your generosity but also your professionalism. And I realized that there's this filmmaking is a shared energy, and we all buoy each other and support each other. And I saw you doing that consistently, and it was very moving, and I think made a huge difference in the performance of the people you were surrounded by.
Yeah, and Jim Belushi, I mean, having been on so many different sets with so many different directors, different styles, I mean, do you bring, obviously you bring that wealth of experience to the set. Is there anything in particular about the dynamic between you as an older actor working with a relatively new filmmaker when you get down to work?
Matt's not a new filmmaker. He's an old soul. He was born a filmmaker and didn't know it, and is just discovering it.
That happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, he observes behavior and culture and records it in his mind and his heart, and then he spills it. I mean, the other three films were very moving, and I loved every moment, even the non-professional actors, because he could get everybody so... I don't know, I think he's an old-time director, and I hope this movie brings him budgets so he can have even more time to shoot, you know, the poetry of his soul and observation of relationships and people.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah. And Jed, you've seen the movie.
I have, and I think it's...
What's your take?
Yeah, I think it's a remarkable movie, worthy of very great filmmakers, as Matt is. And one of the things that's so impressive to me is the relationship between Keith, played by McCall Lombardi, who will be here at the screening, and Jim Belushi can't be because he's working in the West, and his father, played by Jim Belushi, and did they know each other, Matt? How'd you get them together?
Jim and McCall ever met?
Yeah.
No, Jim, you met for the first time in Baltimore, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And you too.
Yeah, exactly. I came out to L.A.
We sat in the backyard here.
We had a nice long lunch.
Yeah. And Jim Belushi, do you get a lot of pitches from filmmakers who are making, you know, relatively low budget films compared to some of the other movies you've made? I mean, and how do you decide? I'll go ahead and jump in on this one.
It's just clear, you know. There's filmmakers that are trying to get into business, and you know, they're a little more commercialized in its structure, and it's like, but you know, I just watched Matt's first three films, and you know, I watched them back to back. To be honest with you, I mean, I couldn't stop watching. It was like watching Game of Thrones or something. I want to see the next one, you know.
Wow.
His observation and the way he gets the natural performance out of people is just, it's nothing complicated. It's not a lot of talking. It's just creating an environment for people to risk. And to me, all the people I've worked with, from Oliver Stone to Polanski to Woody Allen, they create an environment for an actor to exist and risk.
Yep. Mm. That's it, exactly, yeah.
And that's what Matt does. And everybody around him has that same feeling, you know. So, God, everybody can do their best work. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it's captured on the film, you know.
All right, Jim Belushi is one of the stars of Sawler's Point, and he's joined us on the line this afternoon from Los Angeles. Jim, thank you so much for your time, and good luck with the next project. Appreciate it.
Jim, great talking with you. Thanks for calling in. Wish you were here.
I love you, Matt. Good luck. I'm sorry I can't be there, but I have to work real jobs now to kind of make some money.
I understand. I really do. And I'll see you in Los Angeles.
That's right.
Yes,
appearing as a greeter at Walmart, ladies and gentlemen, Jim Belushi. Downtown LA. Right.
Thank you guys for your time, and thank you for your support of this beautiful film by Matt.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. Jim Belushi, he's on the line with us from Los Angeles. Matt Porterfield is a Baltimore filmmaker. This is his fourth feature film. It's called Sawler's Point. It's getting its world premiere as an official selection at this year's Maryland Film Festival. It opens in 20 cities, including Baltimore, at the Parkway Theater a week from Friday. Actually, Baltimore is the first city, and then it opens in the other cities after that. Jed Dietz is with us as well. He's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival and a regular guest on midday at the movies. By the way, Anne Hornaday, our other regular guest, is in Iowa dealing with some medical issues that her dad is undergoing, and we wish her dad and Anne all the best as he recuperates. We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll have more on the Maryland Film Festival. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. To find us on Twitter @MiddayWIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
And welcome back. It's Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's show, my guest will be Floyd Abrams, the lawyer who represented the New York Times in the 1971 Pentagon Papers case and went on to become one of America's leading constitutional scholars. We're going to talk about his most recent book. It's just out in paperback. It's called The Soul of the First Amendment. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review An American in Paris. That's the latest offering at the Hippodrome Theater. So that's all coming up tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, we are previewing the 20th Annual Maryland Film Festival, which gets underway later this evening at the SNF Parkway Theater here in Baltimore. It runs through Sunday. With me in the studio is the festival's founding director, Jed Dietz, as well as filmmaker Matt Porterfield, whose fourth feature film, Soller's Point, is getting its world premiere at the festival. And joining us now in the studio also is Joe Trapea. He's a curator of film and photography at the Maryland Historical Society and the director of a new documentary that will be screened at the festival as well this weekend. It's called Sickies Making Films, and it's about the history of movie censorship in America. Hey, Joe, good to see you.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me in.
Sure, and congratulations on the new movie. If you have questions for our esteemed panel, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to find us on Twitter @MiddayWIPR, and to find us on Facebook, you can go to the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming all the festivities from Studio A. Joe, let's start with a clip from your movie, Sickies Making Films. This is a movie about censorship, the history of censorship in Baltimore and beyond. Here's a little bit.
There were movies that were made simply to exploit the public's prurient interest, to titillate people, or just simply to show them something outrageous that they couldn't see anywhere else.
Sickening, sickie. That's Sickies Making Films.
There's been a long, long fight for the movies to be able to show what they want to show on the screen. They've had to face a lot of roadblocks over the years, and it had to fight to be considered an art form.
And as the Maryland Film Festival so beautifully testifies to, it is certainly, Joe Trapea, considered an art film by now. We heard in that clip Robert Headley. Tell us a little bit about him and the expertise that he brings to your documentary.
Bob Headley is our regional historian expert on Maryland theaters. He's written a couple books, on one on theaters in Baltimore and one on theaters in D.C. So he seemed like a natural person to go to and interview.
And you interview a whole bunch of people about this interesting history, and Baltimore in particular, as a hotbed of movie censorship, it sort of stands out of the crowd when we compare it to other cities.
It does stand out. It lasted here 20 years longer than anywhere else in the nation. So for that alone, it stands out. But it was also our board of censors was filled with a cast of characters that were also a very natural fit for a movie.
And the board of censorship here in Baltimore that, you know, made the decisions about which movies could and couldn't be screened, it lasted until how long?
It lasted until 1981, Tom. Mm.
81. See, I think a lot of people, Jed Dietz, would really be surprised by that. They would think, well, maybe censorship went out in like the 50s or something, right? But 1981, I mean, this was the time when John Waters was making movies. This was the time there were a whole lot of people making movies that couldn't be seen.
Yeah, it's an art form that has challenged people who want to control what other people get to see and think about since its very beginning, and the history of various kinds of censorship, including the self-censorship that is around in the MPAA ratings now, which is clearly a defensive action trying to keep the politicians at bay. But, you know, Kenya just banned a film that just played at Cannes called Rafiki that has homosexuality in it, and they made a big statement that they didn't mind the kissing. They thought the ending was too hopeful. And I,
the Kenyan government's run by a bunch of Debbie Downers? That's crazy.
I don't know.
They want to get rid of all hope in movies? Boy, that's a tough road
something,
to hope.
Something like that. And I do think, you know, when that the Headley in the clip says people were worried about titillation, I mean, I think, isn't that what art does for people? You know, it gets conversations going. It gets you to think about things in movies, in a group, in a movie theater, so you can sort of challenge ideas and each other and have fun afterwards and you know, talking about these ideas. And I think that's what this art form is supposed to do. And this movie shows people trying to challenge that.
Yeah,
it's great.
And Matt Porterfield, for example, with a movie like Soller's Point, you're a new movie, right? Do you submit it to the MPAA? That's the Motion Picture
Association of America.
Association of America, and they assign a rating to it, right?
Yes.
Do you lobby for what the rating you want it to be? I mean, is there a difference between a PG rating and an R rating for your movie? I mean, do you see do you have a preference one way or the other?
I don't have a preference, and I should say that this is the first of my films that has been submitted for an MPAA rating. Our distributor, Oscilloscope, who are releasing the film in the U.S., they submitted. I think it allows you to play in more widely in certain theaters outside of the art house sort of run. Unless you have a rating, you're not going to get booked. So it was advantageous. But it was the first I saw. I didn't know what our rating was, and then I saw the trailer, and there was an R on it. I feel like R is nice and grown up. I mean, I wouldn't feel bad about a PG-13 either.
But would you be concerned, like, if people saw that it was a PG-13, they might say, well, it's not grown up enough.
Too soft.
It's not too soft. Yeah, right.
Yeah, it might be taken as a little bit lightweight.
Yeah. I mean, the censorship board, Joe Trapea, they really did control what was on screens and what wasn't. I mean, this was not something that they were making recommendations or anything, right? They could make sure a movie wasn't ever seen.
They had power in both directions. They could make sure a movie wasn't seen in Baltimore. They could also drive people to go to D.C. where they could see the exact same film uncensored because D.C. didn't have censorship. So, yeah, their power worked in both directions.
And of these characters that you chronicle in the movie, any one or two of them stand out in a big way?
Well, the standout would be Mary Avera, who is a larger-than-life character. And I am just about old enough to almost remember her TV appearances on the daytime talk shows in the 70s.
And was her involvement in the censorship board, you know, animated by a religious conviction, or her sense of moral turpitude came from where?
She was a devout Catholic. She lived in Southwest Baltimore, and she did a lot of good community work, but she certainly saw herself as protecting the children. Now, that said, we talked about titillization. I also heard from people that she used to call them up and invite them to screenings and say, you've got to come see this one. It's outrageous. So why would she be inviting people to come into the censorship screening room to see these films if on some level she also wasn't titillated by them?
But, right. I mean, and Jed Dietz, it does seem to be an evolutionary process, right? I mean, when movies first came out, was there a lot of sex and, you know, flesh and stuff in the beginning? And then, or did it subside and then sort of gradually come? I mean, when you think about what we can see on commercial television these days, for a long time now, we've seen, you know, very intimate moments between characters, and we've heard language that, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, just would be unheard of. But now we have the President of the United States using language, you know, in press conferences, or at least being quoted in meetings. And so that, you know, all of a sudden we're saying the S word on National Public Radio. It's an evolutionary thing, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's not totally trivial. It can become trivial. I think discussing what's appropriate, what feeds you in some way that reveals things to you, anything you look at, any piece of art, whether it's a movie or a painting or sculpture, you know, that's a legitimate question. I just think it should be a question that's out there, and I don't think we're hurt by the question, I think, and therefore we're not hurt by the piece of art. And there are certainly pieces of art that I don't like, most of them because they're boring, I think. And that to me is a much greater offense than, you know, nudity or even violence, actually, in my viewpoint. But I think art forms are there to make us think about stuff that we don't normally think about. And I think they're challenged when people try to, they get offended by something. And instead of just saying, I don't want to see that again, or, you know, I'm going to tell my friends not to see it or whatever, you know, they try to stop other people from seeing that. I think that's where it really starts crossing the line. In the history of movies, you know, it was interesting when movies started, there was no censorship. And then movies created, the first group was the Hays Commission, which got, you know, rule books that were thick and 2 feet on the ground if somebody's sitting on a bed. And all, I mean, they had all sorts of crazy rules that they thought would help Americans, you know, be protected from something. Yeah. I don't even know.
Joe, I mean, we all remember, you know, the Mary Tyler Moore show or the Dick Van Dyke show, yeah, where Mary Tyler Moore and Mr. Van Dyke slept in separate beds, and Lucy and Ricky slept in separate beds. You know, they had twin beds in the bedroom. Well, so
Ricky was the son, Desi.
Or Desi, right. And then we have, you know, it's not too long ago, we've got Janet Jackson at the Super Bowl, you know, having this wardrobe malfunction. And the FCC claims to have fined CBS because of the number of citizen complaints that it received, you know. So is there anything working in the same manner as the censorship board did? I mean, we don't have a censorship board, but right now, when it comes to the world of movies and film and television, for that matter, are there subtle forces at work trying to keep things off the air?
I think it's even more insidious, actually, because you have censorship now from within the industry. And we were talking about the MPAA earlier. They treat different films and filmmakers very differently. So an independent filmmaker is going to have almost no chance to rebut the rating they're assigned. And they're told, you know, we don't give notes as to what's wrong with your film. Whereas a larger budget film will get pages and pages of suggested changes before the rating is even issued. And Kirby Dick did a documentary about this, which I found very informative and caused me to think, well, what came before this MPAA? But yeah, and I think television sort of works the same way. They have network people that sort of decide what flies and what doesn't. And so it looks a lot differently. It acts a lot different, functions a lot differently. But it's perhaps more insidious, in my opinion.
You know, Matt Porterfield, we're at a moment where there is a woman who works in adult films suing the president of the United States, you know? So it's like, once you get to that point, maybe there's just no holds bar for anything. But I wonder, when it comes to creating intimate moments on screen, given the you know, pervasiveness of those kinds of intimate moments that we are exposed to in advertisements on the internet, this YouTube video, that YouTube video, as well as the bazillions of movies we've all seen, it must be a very difficult challenge for a filmmaker to really get it right, to have an intimate moment. I'm just not now talking about sex. We're not going to talk about language or anything else. But when it comes to, you know, filming a sex scene or filming an intimate moment, how do you approach that?
It's extremely hard, and I think you have to approach it carefully and thoughtfully. In fact, I did for the first time in this film. There is a sex scene, a scene of intimacy between two characters that we ultimately cut. Not because it didn't work or wasn't successful. I actually think it captured what felt to me like an authentic moment of intimacy and tenderness. It just didn't really fit with the film as a whole. But, you know, you really want to make sure that the actors are comfortable and they'll have their own limits, which need to be conveyed and then respected. You close the set off. There's no extra people. It's, you know, you create a kind of a situation of relative privacy, given the fact that a film set is fairly public. And then just kind of like make sure that you're checking in with your actors consistently throughout the scene. If they're getting uncomfortable, then you kind of stop and you respect their sort of need to reassert their privacy. So it's this like dance, I think, and everybody's trying to be, you know, cool, comfortable, calm, and collected about the nature of the or the content of the scene. But you know, it's a lot to ask two people, even professionals, to simulate intimacy, you know, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, my daughter's a playwright, and I've conducted a lot of operas, and I've had conversations, we'll say. I won't call them arguments, but I've had conversations with the directors, the stage directors, who've said, you know, this moment has to be intimate. We have to have the woman has to have her shirt off or something like that. And I'd say, you know, it's just not working. It's not going to work as a matter of entertainment on a stage. Now, this is live theater. This is not a movie, and it's different. So it's lit differently, and it's, you know, the perspective of the audience is different. But the directors who've asked for nudity, in particular, on the projects that I've worked on, I've always been able to prevail, usually, too, because they have been convinced ultimately that, you know, it's just not necessary. It's an interesting thing. Jedditz, I want to talk just in general about the role of documentaries, because Joe's one of many documentaries that will be part of the festival lineup this year. You guys have always had a good dollop of documentaries. What's the horizon this year?
Well, the whole art form, one of the things that really came across this year is what unbelievable energy is in movie making right now. I mean, and we're looking at films coming in from people we've never heard of from all over the world. And it's really exciting to see what's going on in this art form. There are a bunch of really great documentaries, Sickie's making film being one of them. But there's a film called Charm City that's in the festival that was just premiered at Tribeca, but was shot over a 3-year period in one of the Baltimore neighborhoods. And the sort of Mr. C, who's one of the organizers around the Rose Street Community Center, and the police who are around that neighborhood, you know, communicating. There's an unbelievable documentary about Jamaica called Black Mother, from a young filmmaker, second film that he's made.
And this, that's on my list.
Yeah. And his mom's Jamaican. He spent his whole life going back and forth to Jamaica. He grew up in New York, and he's a photographer by training, and he has sort of broken through any rules that somebody might try to impose on documentary filmmaking. And both his films, and this one very much, is a real collage of image and sound, sometimes hallucinatory, sometimes very connected. And you really, I've never been to Jamaica, and I think you come out of this film feeling something very special about what this guy who knows and loves this island very much delivers to you about a culture very different from our own.
Yeah. And Joe Trapea, as a filmmaker, I mean, you, like Matt, are Baltimore based here. What's the importance of the fact that this is going to be premiered at the Maryland Film Festival for you as a movie maker in general, and for this particular film in particular?
Well, I mean, this particular film seems like a natural fit for the Maryland Film Festival, so it's a great honor to have it included. John Waters, of course, is part of our story, so that makes it feel special also. I know he's very involved.
He knows a little bit about censorship, doesn't he? Yeah.
His story is very much part of our story.
Those were real challenges for him when he was in his early years.
Absolutely, and he talks about that in the doc.
Yeah. So. Well, we're looking forward to it. We had hoped to hear from Bradford Young. He's a cinematographer who's actually bought a house here in Baltimore. He's worked on movies like Arrival and the new Star Wars movie, but he's shooting a movie in New York with Ava DuVernay called The Central Park Five, and he's evidently not able to join us this afternoon, but he is, Jed Dietz, going to be the host this evening for the short films that always open the Maryland Film Festival.
Yeah, I think because of the shooting, he wrote me this morning that they do an evening scouting of location, so I think he's not going to be with us this evening, I'm sorry to say.
No, so he's missing Midday and the film
right,
festival.
Right, exactly. Okay. But he was all set for Midday, so I don't quite know what's happened there. So this project, Bradford, you know, shot a bunch of independent films. He's a really great cinematographer. Ava DuVernay gave him his first really big break with Selma, and then he was the first African-American to be nominated for an Academy Award for cinematography for Arrival, that film with Amy Adams, and is about to see his new work Solo, a Star Wars movie, be premiered at Cannes and then go into distribution at the end of the month. So we're at, but the Central Park 5 series that they're doing for
it's a Netflix series.
Yeah, mm-hmm. is you know is that commands his schedule when
sure, and it's a very important movie. So we wish him well. We're gonna take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll have more with Joe Trepet and Matt Porterfield and Jed Dietz. We're gonna keep talking about the Maryland Film Festival, and we're gonna be joined, we hope, on the phone from Oakland, California, by Eric Young. He's the director of a new documentary about police violence called "The Blood Is at the Doorstep." You're listening to Midday. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org to find us on Twitter. Twitter at Midday WIPR, and thanks to our good friend and screenwriter Jamila Krempel, we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WIPR.
Ah, yes. The cheesiest arrangement ever done of Hooray for Hollywood indicates, as always, that it's Midday at the Movies. We usually do it on the first Thursday of the month. We're doing it on the first Wednesday because tonight's the night that the 20th annual Maryland Film Festival gets underway at the SNF Parkway Theater. The festival's founding director, Jed Dietz, joins us here in Studio A, along with Baltimore filmmakers Matt Porterfield and Joe Trepea. Matt's new movie is called Soller's Point, and Joe's new documentary is called Sickies Making Films, and both of them will be premiered at the Maryland Film Festival tomorrow. We are joined now on the phone by a filmmaker whose work has been presented at previous Maryland Film Festivals, including last year, and whose new movie will be at the Parkway Theater next week after the festival concludes. So the Maryland Film Festival, its home is at the Parkway Theater, and it's not just this one weekend of the year. Of course, it's all weeks of the year. Eric Young has made a documentary about the 2014 police killing of Dontre Hamilton. He was an unarmed black man in Milwaukee. The movie is called The Blood Is on the Doorstep. It was a critic's pick by The Hollywood Reporter at its premiere at last year's South by Southwest Festival, and it was an official selection of the Maryland Film Festival last year. So Eric Young joins us on the line from Oakland, California. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this story and the movie that you made about it.
Well, yeah, first of all, I just want to say that the Maryland Film Festival, you guys are really lucky to have that in Baltimore. It's an incredible festival. You know, we traveled all over the country with this film, and it's definitely one of our favorite festivals. I mean, it's a very select group of films that get chosen. You know, there's about 30 from all over the country. Most of them are from, you know, Sundance and South by Southwest and a couple premieres as well. But it's really the cream of the crop coming out each year. And you guys, I got to say, I think you guys have the most beautiful theater in the country. The Parkway is absolutely gorgeous, and it's such an honor to play in that venue.
Well, you're going to get no arguments from any of us.
No, thanks so much, Eric.
I actually live in Milwaukee now. I'm in Oakland right now for a screening with Dontre's mother, Maria. We had a screening last night out here, but headed back to Milwaukee now. I'm originally from Northern California, been in Milwaukee for 10 years. So when I moved to Milwaukee, you know, Milwaukee, a lot like Baltimore, has a lot of issues. You know, it's one of the most segregated cities in America, has the highest rate of black male incarceration. So when Dontre was shot just a mile from my house, it was an opportunity for me to be involved in some change in my community of things that, you know, didn't necessarily directly affect me, but affected the community that I live and care about. And I'm not necessarily a protester or a public speaker, but, you know, my skill set is filmmaking and storytelling, and I chose that way to be involved. And, you know, the family wasn't really happy with the coverage of their family and who Dontre was, and so they took a chance on me to tell their story in a more nuanced, long-term way.
And you spent a good bit of time with them. As I understand it, it was about 3 years following the aftermath of Dontre Hamilton's death.
Yeah, I followed the family for about 3.5 years in the aftermath as they kind of fought for reform for justice and to kind of reset the narrative of who Dontre was and who their family was. You know, a lot of times in these situations, a police department is directly involved, but the news stations go directly to the police department that was directly involved and allow them to set the narrative. And oftentimes it's a random family that nobody knows, word against a police department's word once the narrative is already out there. So it's really hard to reset that. And so we kind of followed the Hamilton family for 3 years. As you know, they went to the DA's or the district attorney's house. They went to the mayor's office and kind of publicly forced them to backtrack some of their statements they had made. And it's pretty amazing the work that and change that just one family was able to accomplish in Milwaukee.
Let's listen to a clip from the movie. This is The Blood is at the Doorstep. Our filmmaker, Eric Young, is on the line with us from Oakland, California.
Dontre was a person who didn't deserve to die, who didn't deserve to be shot 14 times.
1246, shots fired, officer involved, Starbucks, help right now.
You don't know this, but when somebody gets killed by a police officer, whoever gets the information out first is the winner.
Subject began to beat the officer with the wooden baton.
They stick to this mental health issue.
He was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Because when you hear mental health, you think this was a crazy person who attacked the officer.
It's an illness. It's nothing that anybody should die for.
And Eric Young, of course, the subject matter writ large of unarmed African-American men being shot, killed, or injured by police remains incredibly potent in American society, as does the issue of mental illness writ large as well. I mean, were you making a film about those larger national issues, or did you want to aspire to make a film that was about this family and their quest for changing the narrative about their son?
We actually started this film prior to Michael Brown and Ferguson. So this really was about this family and what was happening in Milwaukee. And it really is, it's not a reflective documentary. It's a documentary with the family as these things are unfolding. So it's a largely verite documentary. And I was particularly interested because of my own family's issues with mental health issues. You know, I grew up with a cousin who was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, who was literally homeless in my hometown. And people with a diagnosed mental illness are 16 times more likely to be killed by police. Unarmed black men are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than unarmed white men. So both of these issues are incredibly important to be looking at right now. And there's, you know, sustained pressure on these issues over the last couple of years. And it's interesting to see how things kind of pop up in different news cycles. You know, there's a lot talking about Starbucks right now. And this whole incident started from multiple calls from a Starbucks employee. Dontre was resting outside of a Starbucks on a bench, and a Starbucks employee called multiple times to have him removed. Police came twice, told them to stop calling the police. Dontre was in a public park. He was doing nothing wrong. And they called again, and the third officer came, and, you know, what happened to Dontre was a result of that.
Incredibly sad story, and Jed Dietz, this is a very powerful movie.
It's a very powerful movie, and it's a great example of what filmmaking can do, because Eric has identified fascinating characters through which we see these issues evolve. And the police chief, Flynn, is a very interesting character, and you see from his point of view, and you see from the family's point of view, the family, as the film starts, really facing this great tragic loss in their midst. But I can think of no other art form that can quite pull this together. And we had this in the festival last year, and we're very proud to have it at the Parkway as part of its theatrical run. As these issues evolve in our country, the filmmaking world, I think, has responded to it really beautifully in a way that I don't think any other part of our culture can do.
Well, Eric Young, congratulations on the movie. It will open on Monday after the film festival is over for this year. And we appreciate your taking the time this afternoon. And good luck with it as it continues its theatrical release.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And thanks for having us back in Baltimore.
Sure.
I love the city, so thank you.
All right. Sir. Eric Young has joined us on the phone from Oakland, California. So, gentlemen, when we have just a few minutes left, let me ask you, Matt Porterfield, as a not only as a filmmaker, but as a person who studies the lineup at every Maryland Film Festival quite carefully, what are the ones that you've got your eye on in particular?
Certainly. Definitely Black Mother, Kalikala, which Jed mentioned. I'm also interested in a documentary called Caniba by Lucian Casting Taylor and Verena Paravel, a filmmaking team who brought us Leviathan a few years back, played the festival. It's about a Japanese cannibal who killed a fellow student when he was in his 20s in Paris and then was extradited to Japan. It's extensive interviews with this guy who's now quite old. And enjoying life as a free man. I also would pay close attention, or make mention of I Am Not a Witch, which is a Zambian film that's really special and bittersweet and funny, too. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. Madeline's Madeline, I also want to see, from American filmmaker
Josephine Decker. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah,
those are a few.
Those are some good things. Joe Trepe, how about you? Got your eye on anything in particular?
I definitely have my eye on Matt's new film. A documentary I would recommend is called Father's Kingdom, directed by Lenny Feinberg. It tells a very untold piece of American history, the story of Father Divine, and I guess you could call it sort of his cult or sort of his religious following. It's a fascinating story. Anyone who got hooked on Wild Wild Country on Netflix will definitely want to come see this film.
And Jed Dietz, there are a bunch of movies that are premiering at the festival and then they're going to be in theaters. There's this one that's called Will You Be My Neighbor about Mr. Rogers, and that's going to open at the Charles Theater in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, and you know, don't miss this. Any way you can see it, it's really an extraordinary movie. A documentary about a very a guy easy maybe to dismiss, who you shouldn't dismiss in our culture. Very important guy in our culture.
Love Fred Rogers.
Yeah.
Tell us about the movie that John Waters is going to introduce. He introduces a film every year.
Yeah.
What's he picked for everybody this year?
Yeah, this is the only festival I know of anywhere that John has done this for 20 years in a row, where he picks films that you're likely not to have heard of, and then whatever the film is, you're going to learn a lot about movie making in a very entertaining way, because the way he intros and does Q&A afterwards is really great. This is a film called I, Olga Heprovna. It comes out of Eastern Europe. It's a narrative, a fictional film, but based on a true story. It got a good deal of critical attention, but not a big commercial hit. And again, I'm assuming most listeners haven't heard of it, but seeing one of these introduced and championed by John is a great experience, no matter what the movie is.
Yeah, and the final night is going to be a film called All Square. Maryland Film Festival has a really good track record with final night films. Yeah. Hurt Locker was a final night film a few years ago, and then all of a sudden it won the Academy Award. This is a film shot right here in Baltimore by the crew that works on House of Cards, because it stars one of the guys who's in House of Cards, Michael Kelly.
Yeah, and another wonderful cast surrounding him, too. Harris Yulin is in it. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. from The Wire is in it. This is a script that had been around for a while. It was hard to get made. It's about a small-time bookie whose life is really getting complicated because the betting's all going to the internet. And then he comes up with a scheme that works for a little bit.
And then stuff happens.
Yeah. And Michael Kelly is sensational. The whole cast is great. Michael and a lot of the cast are going to be here for closing night.
Excellent. Well, break a leg to all three of you for the film festival this week.
Tom.
Appreciate everybody coming in. Thanks so much. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. It opens tonight, runs through Sunday at the Parkway, as well as at several venues at MICA. And we've got a link to the program, wypr.org/midday. Matt Porterfield's new movie also premieres. It's called Soller's Point. And Joe Trepea's new flick is called Sickies Making Films. It's about film censorship. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Floyd Abrams, the award-winning lawyer and legal scholar. He's the author of a book called The Soul of the First Amendment, in which explains the unique place of speech and press freedom in American history and in the American psyche. That's coming up tomorrow along with theater critic J. Wynn Russick. She's going to review An American in Paris, the latest offering at the Hippodrome Theater. Lunch for our midday guests today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. They've got more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Stay tuned for Life in the Balance with Aaron Henkin. That's coming up right after the NPR News at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a wonderful time at the Maryland Film Festival and have a great day.